The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes in the state are still trying to work out a effective plan to get rid of lake trout in Flathead Lake. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Valentine, and Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capital reporter Dan Boyce looks at why the tiny town of Wolf Creek wants a resort tax. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with Missoula writer Pete Fromm about a new movie based on his book, As Cool as I Am. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks would consider a small-scale netting program for non-native lake trout in Flathead Lake. This stance is in response to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes moving ahead on more aggressive lake trout management. The state and the tribes had a 10-year-old co-management plan expire in 2011. The sticking point between the two entities is the best way to manage the non-native lake trout. Netting is an option identified in the co-management plan, but the state has said netting might do more harm than good. The Bonneville Power Administration recently announced it would not help fund the netting effort unless the state and tribes reached consensus. Katrin Fry reports negotiations between the tribes and the state continue.
Regional Supervisor for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, Jim Satterfield, says the state is considering a pilot program for netting in Flathead Lake, but netting lake trout makes them nervous.
Our biggest concern is that you can actually do more harm than good in a suppression effort if you have high bycatch, which is just a term for catching fish that you don't want to catch in your nets. In this case, if you catch, when you're netting lake trout, it's very easy to also net bull trout. And lake trout gill netting is a pretty injurious form of sampling. You have high mortality rates with gill netting.
Satterfield says the state would consider a pilot netting program during an interim period while FWP and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes worked on an updated co-management plan. He says building a plan is generally a multi-year process.
Pilot implying that a small-scale project to just evaluate a lot of different questions surrounding netting.
Satterfield says those questions include bycatch of unintended species, netting locations, and type of gear. He says that's what's on the table right now, and the tribes and state continue negotiating. The tribes completed a draft environmental impact statement this summer and are moving forward with the most aggressive option for lake trout removal. This option allows for reducing the lake trout population by up to 75%. Manager for the CSKT Division of Fish, Wildlife, Recreation, and Conservation, Tom McDonald, says this is a maximum, and the first year of implementation would look a lot like what Satterfield is talking about.
So we're not going to go right out there and lay out, if needed, a whole bunch of nets. We're going to step into this very smartly and see what the reaction is from the fisheries that we affect, and do it the best way possible not to impact bull trout or West Slope cutthroat trout.
Protecting native bull trout and West Slope cutthroat trout are important management goals on both sides of the lake, as is preserving the recreational fishery. McDonald says the tribes want to continue with a co-management agreement.
But at this point in time, until we exhaust all the tools under the current management, we don't know what we would, there is no need or we don't know what we would do differently than what we're currently doing.
One of the more popular management tools over the past decade has been increasing angling pressure by holding spring and fall mack days to catch the Mackinaw or lake trout. Northwest Montana is 4 weeks into the 7-week fall mack days event, and fisheries biologist Barry Hansen with the tribes says anglers have reeled in nearly 8,500 fish so far.
Mack days has been going extremely well this fall. We've been very fortunate with the very good weather, and as a result, the harvest has been up and a little higher than last year, for example.
Hansen says they catch and tag 5,000 fish prior to the event. Bringing in a tagged fish gets you a cash prize, with some of the largest individual prizes being $5,000 or $10,000 for the right fish. He says last weekend someone brought in a fish worth $5,000. The tribes offer a total of $125,000 in prize money through anglers catching tagged fish, the most fish, and other categories. The funding comes from the Bonneville Power Administration and from the tribes. BPA recently announced that it would not fund netting efforts without consensus from the tribes and the state on the practice. McDonald says the tribes would pay for netting from other resources. However, both he and Satterfield with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks say coming back to a place of agreement and co-management remains the goal. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
And in other news from around the state, The Montana Department of Corrections has agreed to offer a boot camp for female prisoners to settle claims it discriminated against women inmates by requiring them to participate in degrading treatment programs. The American Civil Liberties Union of Montana announced the settlement today in a lawsuit the group brought on behalf of seven inmates at the Montana Women's Prison in Billings. The state also agreed to pay $50,000 in attorney fees. The lawsuit targeted the prison's six-year-old Right Living Community program. The ACLU claimed female inmates who participated received little training and were forced to participate in mandatory rounds of children's games like Duck, Duck, Goose. The boot camp for women will begin this Friday in Deer Lodge and offer an alternative to incarceration that's already available to some male defendants.
Some residents in the town of Wolf Creek are looking to change their tiny hamlet north of Helena into a resort. Or at least, they are hoping to set up a resort tax. Capital reporter Dan Boyce takes a look at how the town wants to get some extra money from tourism without paying the tax themselves.
Brothers Gene and Ed Curtis are just sitting down for lunch at the Frenchman. It's a cafe and bar in Wolf Creek. They're both wearing Hunter's Orange ball caps.
Well, we're after elk, which we've been successful. We're now after the white-tailed deer, which we've been half successful.
They also plan to catch some trout in the nearby Missouri River. The Curtis brothers come from California. They travel up to this area regularly, staying at a lodge in town for 10 or 12 days. Ed says in California, there are always proposals for new resort taxes. Here, there, everywhere.
I mean, it's just tax, tax, tax. Enough is enough.
And when he hears his vacation spot here in Wolf Creek is thinking of setting up a resort tax, he's not happy about it.
This kind of stuff is what deters people from coming. It's just a progressive way of milking the public.
The people in Wolf Creek would not be asking for a resort tax if they weren't faced with the burden of putting in a sewer system that, quite frankly, they can't afford.
Pat Hunter lives just outside of Wolf Creek. He's a commercial fisherman in Alaska in the summer. He lives here the rest of the year. And he says community members asked him to work on getting this tax implemented during his winter downtime. He says the 30 or so buildings that make up the core of Wolf Creek each have their own drain fields for wastewater. 50 years ago, these homes and businesses were in compliance with the law, but not anymore. He says water quality standards now say each building would need a drain field a couple acres in size to let wastewater dissipate enough that it's not getting into drinking water. A couple acres. The buildings in Wolf Creek are tightly packed into a canyon. They don't have that kind of space.
We know that the neighbor is probably drinking water from their neighbor that hasn't really been filtered properly. We know that.
So the community needs a septic system, which Hunter says will probably cost about $3 million or more. He says the 40 or 50 full-time residents of the area need help paying for that. So begins the quest for a resort tax. The Montana Department of Commerce says right now there are 8 Montana communities or areas that have resort taxes, places like Whitefish, West Yellowstone, Big Sky. They have to meet certain population and land guidelines set by the legislature, and the majority of the economic base within the area has to rely on tourism. The tax can be up to 3%, and Commerce Department senior economist Joe Ramler says all the money earned goes back to the community, not the state or county.
It's up to the area, the local officials, and constituents to decide what they want to spend that tax revenue on.
And what is taxed is basically up to the community, too. It needs to fall under the loose framework of luxury items. Tax supporter Pat Hunter says a visiting tourist or a resident would not be charged the tax for a loaf of bread, but would be charged for items like fly rods or lodging. He says making these distinctions will be challenging for the community.
If he buys a sweatshirt that says Wolf Creek on it, he's going to pay 3%. If he buys a sweatshirt that doesn't say Wolf Creek, it's a necessity of life. He's not going to pay 3%.
But Hunter believes it's necessary to go through this process. He worked on a resort tax for the nearby town of Craig a few years ago. He says residents were skeptical about the tax back then, but have come around after seeing it generating more money for the community than expected. Hunter thinks much of Wolf Creek is behind him in this effort.
Yeah, and now, if you guys are coming and you're using services, isn't it only fair that you pay a tiny bit of it?
Hunter tries to explain the idea to the Curtis brothers in the Frenchman Cafe, the two brothers against resort taxes.
You can do the same thing without a tax.
After he tells them the tax revenue would only be used by the immediate area, that the state or county government would not be seeing it, they seem to come around too. Gene Curtis says he's all for having clean groundwater.
If groundwater is leaking into the river, then, you know, that stuff needs to be taken care of. You know, a few dollars is not going to kill me. For a tax, it'll keep the environment clean.
Wolf Creek is now submitting their tax plan to the Department of Commerce. If approved, it eventually goes back to the people within the resort tax area for a vote. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting in Wolf Creek.
12 Montana communities that are actively working to increase high school graduation rates and college preparatory skills will share $50,000 in grants to support college readiness programs. These Graduation Matters communities will receive grants ranging from $2,000 to $5,000. The funds are being offered through Montana's Office of Public Instruction and the Student Assistance Foundation, a not-for-profit that helps students pursue and fund their post-secondary education. Denise Juneau is Montana's state school superintendent. Juneau says these Graduation Matters Montana Student Assistance Foundation college readiness funds are used to increase awareness of federal aid available to students.
To promote dual credit courses, to help students with college and career exploration, and make sure that we're doing as much as possible to help students go to college if they want to. And the great work that's been going on and that we learned from last year from some of these schools is the awareness matters. And when students fill out those applications for federal aid, it provides a significant amount of resources for them to attend college.
Juneau says this funding investment could leverage about $4 million in federal grant funding for Montana students.
If these communities follow through with their grants and they do everything they say they're going to do, the number of students who will fill out the FAFSA, or the federal aid forms, that is the return of federal funds that they'll receive in order to go to college. So it's a great investment, and that just shows how much can be done with a little bit of money, a little bit of focus, and a little bit of awareness. And so this partnership with the Student Assistance Foundation is really great.
Communities receiving awards from the Graduation Matters Montana Student Assistance Foundation College Readiness Fund include Anaconda, Bozeman, Browning, Columbia Falls, Eureka, Great Falls, Hardin, Hot Springs, Libby, Livingston, Missoula, and Thompson Falls.
A film based on Missoula author Pete Fromm's 10-year-old novel, As Cool As I Am, debuted recently in Missoula. It's a coming-of-age tale about a teenage girl, played by the up-and-coming Irish actress Sarah Bolger. The star of the hit TV series Homeland, Claire Danes, plays the girl's mother. In this feature interview, Fromm talks with news director Sally Mock about the novel and the film of the same title. Fromm says the novel grew out of a short story he wrote called The Gravy on the Cake.
I once worked with a guy as a park ranger in the Tetons who unwittingly screwed up every old saying he said. And he said a lot of them. And the first one I ever heard, he was trying to say the icing on the cake. But he said, well, if we could do that, that would just be the gravy on the cake. And he would say things like, don't sit there like a dump on a log. and they were so unique that I started to write them down. And years later, I pulled that out as a story idea and said, let's try to make somebody who says the gravy on the cake. And it quickly became apparent that I couldn't make it believable that someone wasn't doing that on purpose. And so I had to figure out, well, why would somebody talk like that? And so I thought of a dad who wasn't home very often, who would try to be over-the-top fun, goofy. And so he...
Cool.
Yeah, cool. And he did this all the time. And rather than his point of view, I thought it would be better to show it from one of his children's point of view. And... well, maybe the best place would be a girl hitting adolescence.
And how did you come to that? Because the central character in the book and in the film is a teenage girl. And here you are, middle-aged guy.
Right. Well, I thought for the story, if the narrator was a teenage girl and who had a father who was never there, that this would be the opening of the biggest rift between them, where she's going into womanhood, which is something he doesn't understand, and he's kind of tried to raise her as a tomboy, and it was just the idea that that would be the most interesting, to open this family up more. And then I found myself writing, oh my gosh, now I'm writing from the first person point of view of a teenage girl, which is not what I'd expected. But people always ask of, how is that possible? How can you do it? And you know, my wife calls my job sitting in my basement playing with my imaginary friends. And if you do that all the time and you're making stuff up, it's not that difficult to put yourself into another skin. And the gender difference, I think, working just with the emotions, the emotions are more universal than people realize. You know, people get elated, get sad in pretty much the same way. So if you can make the emotion true that somebody thinks, wow, that's how that would feel, they can get into the character without worrying about the picture of the mustache guy on the back of the book.
How did the book become a film?
Through no fault of mine whatsoever. Jen Sprague, the wife of the writer Mark Sprague, who's a friend of mine, just said, asked me, could I do a screenplay of this? She and Mark have worked together on screenplays before. And she said the book just really struck a tone with her. And she asked, could I do a screenplay and see what happens? And sure.
How hard is that? Because it's another writer rewriting your stuff.
Right. Right.
And well, how collaborative was that? Or did she go off and it was done and take it or leave it?
Well, it wasn't weird at all to me because I had no experience with it. I just said, yeah, go for it. And she was fabulous. She showed me kind of her, not her first draft, but a draft that she was comfortable with and said, I want you to see this. I want to really be true to what you tried to do, but it's my story. And so this isn't a collaboration, but if there's things in here that really bother you, I want to know. And which is way more access than a writer usually gets. And
right, once you sell the rights, you're...
Right, they buy the story, and it's theirs. And so she went way beyond anything she had to do, and then through the whole course of the movie kept me informed of what they were doing, who they were looking at for casting, and everything.
The film, it seems to me, has a literary tone to it, mm-hmm. which I think means that she stuck pretty close to your book.
Right. She went in, she said, you know, I have to find my way into the story. So there's changes made that are what she felt she needed to do to get into the story. And there's other changes made that are understandable. In the book, Lucy, through most of the early half of the book.
Lucy's the lead teenage character.
Right. Her father gives her a buzz cut. And they really had trouble finding a teenage actress who could shave her head. Mostly they were willing, but they were also in other projects. Sarah Bolger, who plays Lucy, was in a HBO or BBC series, and so she couldn't show up to work at that with a shaved head. Mm-hmm. And so Jen warned me, said, this will probably be a problem. We have to figure out a way to all the metaphor and stuff that you use by having her shave her head. We've got to write an alternate to get around that. And mm-hmm. so she came up with a way to do that. So some of them is just kind of technical stuff. And some is her way in to the story. And it is, the movie was made 10 years after the book was out. And so I had a long remove between the two. So that offered some free separation for me. So it wasn't as difficult, I think, that it could be to see things change.
The lead character is played by Sarah Bolger, who's an Irish actress, and she's been on television and some other things and done a couple of the movies, but she's not a well-known actress in this country yet. But boy, she's terrific in this.
Yeah.
So believable.
Yeah, she, I went down, they filmed in Albuquerque, and I went down to watch a few days of filming, and my son's got to be extras in the high school scenes, and she was the scenes I watched with her, she was making me choke up, and I knew it was coming. And she was with Claire Danes, who I expected to be, I expected her to be fabulous. And Sarah was all but stealing the scenes. She was an incredible surprise.
Yeah. Claire Danes, of course, is one of the hottest actresses around right now because of her starring in the Showtime series Homeland.
Right.
You must have been thrilled to get a name like that.
I didn't mind at all. The other, everybody wants to know, what's Claire Danes like? And our experience on the set from the first minute to the last was unbelievable. We sat down for lunch after I'd warned the boys, don't get in the way. We're just tourists. I am a nobody here. And so we sat at the end of a table at the lunch break and Claire came and sat down with us and wanted to meet the boys and thank me for writing the book and getting everything started.
Sounds like none a real this, person.
Yeah, none of the prima donna stuff that you've heard about. The director was, he really wanted to follow the book too. And he had an explanation for the different stories that I thought was really good. He said, you started it. You're the reason we're all here. And, you've invented Lucy, you made her come to life. And then Jin had to take that story and make it her story. And then Jin had to give
the screenwriter.
Right. And Jin had to give me the story. And now it's my story to do. We all wanted to stay true to what brought us here, but we all have our own storytelling takes. And that just seemed to make sense to me.
So now that you've had a film made out of one of your books, Pete, do you now write thinking, wow, I wonder if this could be a movie?
No. No, it would be like winning the lottery once and saying, well, I wonder if I can do that again.
Because there are writers who write with that in mind.
Right. No, I never thought about this ever. And I still don't. I really, what I love about writing is becoming somebody else. And
going down to your basement and playing with your
exactly, imaginary characters. Exactly. And I think if I was starting to think, oh, who could play this person? Or how would this look on film? For me, the writing is very visual to begin with, which is why I think that they make the adaptation to film is fairly easy. I've had one short story become a short film, and now there's some negotiations going on for another novel for the film rights. And I think for that, I would like to try to write a screenplay from that novel, but I would never want to try to write an original screenplay. I'm working on a new novel now, and people ask that a lot. Are you writing with film in mind? And like, no, I'm writing to see, how does this guy get out of this? How does he live through his life? And if something would happen with that later on, that'd be great. But it's not
gravy on the cake.
Exactly. You're good, Sally. That would be the gravy on the cake for sure.
Well, I have been speaking with author Pete Fromm, and we've been talking about his novel, As Cool As I Am, which has been made into a very, very nice movie by the same title. Pete, congratulations on all the success.
Oh, thanks. It's been, like I said, I didn't have a lot to do with it. I just started it rolling.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly clear with lows 5 to 12 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly sunny skies with highs in the 40s. Central Montana tonight should be mostly clear with lows 15 to 20 degrees. Tomorrow calls for sunny skies with some patchy freezing fog in the morning and highs in the 40s. Southwest Montana tonight should be partly cloudy with isolated snow showers through the night and lows 15 to 20 degrees. Tomorrow, we expect partly cloudy skies with some patchy freezing fog in the morning and highs 40 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Pat Williams.
I remember a year in the early 1950s when The nation, our state, and my hometown of Butte, Montana were all suffering through a more than year-long economic recession. My parents owned restaurants in Butte, and business was hurting for them as it was for almost everyone. Not yet a teenager, I remember my dad trying to convince Mom that come spring we should put a new front on the building. Mom objected, saying the times were too difficult. Customers were not walking through the doors the way they had, and the restaurant's rainy day fund was already being tapped. Mom, you see, was in charge of the menu and food buying in our restaurants. She hired, fired, and established the employee schedules. Dad took care of the finances and our investments, including silent partnerships in other restaurants. For several months that winter, they discussed the idea of a new storefront, and Mom finally agreed. So, come spring, our main restaurant candy store combination, which was smack in the middle of downtown Butte on Park Street, received an expensive facelift. I remember Dad explaining to our customers and insisting to his fellow small business friends in the area that now is the right time to invest. His logic was that building contractors needed the work, Butte's people wanted jobs, the appearance of downtown was important, and he insisted interest rates were only going up. He firmly believed that one invested in oneself by investing in one's customers and the city. That time, more than half a century ago, comes to be now because of news that the wealthy are hoarding their money. The nation's 500 largest corporations are reported to be sitting on perhaps $3 trillion of balance funds. At this time of needed spending, smart investing, more jobs, and more money circulating on Main Street, our wealthiest companies have their trillions of dollars in the mattress. I believe that one of the economic problems we have today has been brought on by limited allocation of capital by the private sector. We can all agree that the private sector must act rationally, practice bottom-line restraint, and respect the current reduced demand for goods and services. We also know, or should know, that President Obama's early stimulus strategies stopped the dangerous hemorrhaging of financial markets and directly created and protected well over 2 million jobs. However, government acting alone and without the full and aggressive cooperation of the private sector means a staggering economy and a suffering people, and we have too much of both today. The truth of it is that neither major corporations nor rich individuals are stepping up to help. The financially well-off, and let's define that for our purpose as those earning in excess of $250,000 each year, have a major effect on America's well-being. Fully one-third of products, goods, and services are purchased by the top 5% of income earners. Those are the very people who have cut their personal spending and are building their excesses. One of the economic indicators is, of course, housing foreclosures. Most middle-income Americans are trying to pay their mortgages, even in homes that are financially upside down and underwater. But a close look shows you that's not true of the rich. They simply abandoned their second or third homes and dumped the cost on the taxpayer or the local bank. From Silicon Valley to the exclusive gated communities here in the Northern Rockies, the wealthy trashed our state's economies by simply walking away from their legitimate financial obligations. So what we see now is that the boys in the big boardrooms are not only not spending, but they have simply abandoned their debts. During the Great Depression, Franklin D. Roosevelt once said, "We have always known that greed was bad morals. Now we know it's bad economics as well." Oh, one thing more about my dad. Following the completion of that new expensive storefront, we had a significant increase in customers, enjoying the new look of the place. And we thought saying thanks by bringing a friend along with him to enjoy a steak dinner, or buy a box of candy, or simply throw in an extra dime on the counter for another cup of coffee. It paid off. This is Pat Williams. Thanks for listening.
Pat Williams is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.